This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Can you, buddy?
Hello, sir. How are you?
All right, very good.
The process of to get this to where it is now seems to be a story in itself. And it began as a Brad Pitt was going to be in it, and that's a blonde guy and another and a blonde girl.
Yeah.
And you're going to shoot it in Australia about 3 years ago, right?
Yes, sir.
Talk about how what the process was to get it to where it is now, and how frustrating it has been.
Where are you from?
Australia.
Which publication?
Well, here I write for Dark Horizons.
Dark Horizons. All right, good to meet you. It's a.
Sorry, just making sure.
Oh yeah, sure. it was a very long process, and I think all of my projects have been really challenging. No one really wanted to make a black and white movie about God and math. And then after Pi, and everyone was like, "What do you want to do? What do you want to do next?" And I sent them a copy of Requiem for a Dream. They were all like, silence. And barely anyone called me back. And I think The Fountain, for some reason, we choose films that are just what we think is interesting and cool, and they're just a little bit outside the box. So it's always a big challenge. And Brad got really interested at the beginning, and that gave it a lot of fuel. And I always wanted a big movie star for it, because I knew, when I started this film, I was really inspired by science fiction novels and graphic novels, in the sense that, you'll be reading a science fiction novel, and for the first 100 pages, you really don't know what the hell's going on, and then suddenly a few words show up, and suddenly all these clues, and the world opens up, and you're smack in the middle of Neal Stephenson's world, and it suddenly all makes sense. And I wanted to give that similar experience for The Fountain, and so the first 20 minutes of the film is you're afloat, and then suddenly you meet Rachel, and the world starts to come together, and you realize that all those scenes actually do mean something, and it does add up to something. And my hope was that by putting a movie star into it, it could hook the audience in to help them get through that 20 minutes. So when Brad expressed interest, it was great. It started all going, and then we got really close, and the much publicized shaving of the beard, and then it basically fell apart, and there was $18 million against it, and a lot of spilled blood, and there was really no chance that anything would ever happen, and I tried really hard to clean my palate and start something new, and all the stuff we actually started new is probably what we're going to do next, but so that time didn't go to waste. But then, one night I just couldn't get it out of my system, and I just started to write again. And this, not having to write for a studio or for an actor freed me up to return to what was really important to me.
Speaking of that beard that we all know that look was intended for this film, and now there is that look is not in the film. Like, did you trade that for the shaved head, or is it something else?
No, the look is he was growing the beard for the conquistador sequences.
Oh, it was much longer on him.
It took a long time to get the set. Yes. I don't know how much longer it was than Hugh's beard in the battle scene. I think it was probably pretty similar. Hugh had a big thing, but I mean, Brad had a big issue about prosthetic beards. He wanted to grow it.
Darren, watching the movie again last night, I realized every element of every timeline is in every other timeline. It's a very fractal picture. Everything's related. How did you build that in? Did that come in the script stage, or the stuff that you were adding in as you were shooting? You're like, I need to have this image again. How did that go?
It's all pre-planned. I mean, with the budget that we had, which was extremely low, and the limited amount of time, which was extremely short to do something like this, it was all about homework. So all those connections were made beforehand. Of course, things came up where we realized, hey, we could stick that here, and things happened on set. But I'd say 95% of all decisions are beforehand. Because when you get to set, no matter how much two-dimensional work you do, meaning storyboard, shot list, script work, as soon as you get into a three-dimensional space with real live actors and real physical equipment, nothing ever works out. So you have to be able to adapt. But having done all that homework allows you to know what you need, absolutely need, so you could get pretty close to getting everything you want. But all the shots, like the wish shots of the horse going by and the ship going by and the car going by, that was all pre-planned. The connection of all the star fields that are going on throughout the film, you know, in space, of course, and then the candles all hanging down. Once you throw them out of focus, they're a star field. The Christmas lights behind Rachel on the rooftop, star fields. From working with darkness and light in the same way where Hugh's character is in the black and Rachel's character is in the white. Hugh's never really fully lit till the end of the film, and Rachel's lit all the time. That was always planned and you know, 10 months before we ever got to set.
Was it Hugh that actually suggested Rachel for this?
Yeah. Did Hugh tell you that, or Rachel?
Well, I'm not going to reveal the source, but... yeah.
Well, I wasn't into the idea because, you know, I had a personal relationship with Rachel, and I didn't want to, you know, it's a gamble, you know. Either the relationship was going to be over or the relationship would be fine. So, you know, why risk something like that? And Hugh suggested the idea. I wasn't open to it. And then he said, well, let's at least meet. And so we had dinner at a vegan restaurant. And they just, actually it wasn't vegan, it was macrobiotic, but I don't know the difference, so. And they just completely connected, and it was just, it was electric, you know. It was one of those things, as a director, you hope happens in a casting room, which rarely ever happens, where you see two actors look at each other and understand each other. So the thing about Hugh and Rachel is, they were both extremely hungry actors at the time. Now they're big-time movie stars. So now I don't know about working with them. But back then, just saying that aside, back then they were both incredibly well... They're stage actors, and they're incredibly well-trained, and they both hadn't had the opportunity to really show what they could do. And that, to me, is the most exciting act. You know, like Ellen Burstyn, she's done great stuff, but she... It's been a long time. Jennifer Connelly and Marlon Wayans, they all had... They had a reason to show up.
Did directing Rachel exceed your expectations? Was it?
She's amazing, and you know, I describe her as a cauldron of emotions, and you just turn up the heat, and things start boiling over. And she's one of those actors that you can get four or five different emotions in one choice. And to me, that's amazing. I mean, like that speech she talks about Moses Morales, about the guy who's buried and grew up into the tree. That's one take. And you find that very, very few actors out there that can hold an extreme close-up this tight for 40 seconds. And actually, originally, you know, well, I cut it up like crazy. The first time we cut the film together, it was in pieces. I took the best from here and the best from there. And it worked. But then I said, you know what, we should go through her material once again. And then we stumbled on that piece, which just worked all the way through. And it was like, you know, that's, you got to let an actor shine when they do something like that.
So in the different parts of your work, you started out as The Last Man and became Tom 1.0 and now Tom 2.0 finally. What actually was changed? Was it just...
The Last Man was always the Fountain 0.1. That was just a secret title that, you know, I'm a pretty paranoid guy. And so we just called it The Last Man. It was always called The Fountain. That was just a false title. And I don't know, somehow the script got out there and it got leaked and it became The Last Man, but it was never The Last Man. It was actually a working title for us at the very beginning. There was this... one of the big inspirations for the book was, for the film, was this short story about a prisoner who was in this brand new prison in a town in Latin America, and there was a volcano, and everyone in the town was wiped out except for the guy who survived in the new prison cell. And there was something about immortality and being alone that kind of captured what we were going for. That's basically what morphed into what we made, which is just interesting how a little seed of an idea can become something else. And so Fountain 1.0 is available. You can see it in the graphic novel, out on hardcover and softcover by DC Vertigo. But
available now.
Available now. It's very, very similar. I mean, ultimately, there's a few differences, and I think that, you know, there was a huge battle scene at the beginning of Fountain 1.0, but this was kind of in a post-Gladiator, pre-Peter Jackson landscape. So, you know, I was, like, very excited by what Ridley had done in Gladiator, and I was like, well, this is exciting. We can make a really exciting battle scene. But then I went through my trials and tribulations, and then Lord of the Rings came out. And I was like, well, you know, our Mayan conquistador battle will never go to that level of fantasy and extremity. So why even, you know, do it? And then, of course, Troy came out and King Arthur. So that was sort of all these huge battle scenes had happened. Hollywood had done it. And I realized audiences were, like, yawning you know, when they saw it. So I was like, you know what? This scene is written by Izzy for Tommy. Everyone get that? It's in the book. What's the story? The story is one man overcoming incredible odds. So it very, very much got down to eventually Hugh Jackman against the Mayan army. And that's all I really needed. And it just, the simplicity of that just kind of liberated me, because then I suddenly realized I didn't need $20 million to shoot it. I could do it for a lot less. And that was a budget thing. Yes?
I've never seen Hugh Jackman in such an emotional role. And I wonder if you had seen him in something that you felt, oh, my God, he could do this. Because I'm not sure I would have thought he could.
Well, how many male actors have you actually seen do emotional work like
that's
that?
That's true.
I mean, on the road, that's come up. I've been, like in 15 cities in the last 2-3 weeks. And a lot of different people have said to me, women have said to me, I've never seen a man that vulnerable on or off screen. And, I didn't really know, what he could do. Because when I first started this, he wasn't on my list. Because he had just done Wolverine.
Yeah.
And, which he was fantastic as. And, became a star off of. Which is an amazing, difficult thing to do if you're a fan. Just to step into that role out of nowhere and actually pull it off. It was a big accomplishment. But I hadn't seen nothing else. So then when I saw The Boy from Oz, I just saw an incredible amount of talent. It was undeniable. Outside of what he did in The Fountain, the guy can sing and dance. I mean, it's really kind of upsetting. he went from... it's just remarkable what he did in this movie, and it's overlooked somewhat, but, here's Wolverine, right? The second time I met Hugh, randomly at a bar or something with some of his friends. We just said hello. And then I was at a hotel. We were staying at the same hotel. And I'm sitting there kind of doing my curls, my 20-pound curls. And this guy's moving a machine across the room. It was, pulling this thing, and the machine's jumping. I'm like, oh, what the hell? Who is that freak? And it was Hugh Jackman training for X-Men 2. And I went over and I said, hey, how you doing? And so he stuck. But then Hugh went from that type of size to, in 12 months, being able to get into full lotus position, which, if anyone's ever done yoga, I've been doing it for 7-8 years, I can't get into lotus position. But he got into full lotus and performed all those scenes where he's in lotus underwater, where he's float, to make his float attached to a barbecue rig.
Oh, wow.
So that when he flips over and goes upside down, the rig basically spun him around upside down, held him upside down for like 10 seconds, and then brought him back up where he would land on that ship for that big revealing shot of the bubble. That was one of the shots he did underwater and in character. Physically, you won't find a specimen on the planet like him. I mean, this is the type of guy that could have been an Olympic athlete, gold medalist in so many different sports. Who knows? So that was amazing. I mean, we had a stunt double. And I know it's kind of cliche that he did all of his stunts, but we had a stunt double, but he was better than the stunt and everything. So he climbed the tree. That's him climbing the tree. Time after time after time. Everything in the movie. The fights, just everything. And outside of that, emotionally, he just unleashed. And I think the first time we were first doing the emotional scene, you start off wide. That's the traditional way to shoot a scene. You start off wide because it establishes the lighting, and then you go in for close-ups. We got the camera. Suddenly, these faucets start to open, and it's like, okay, cut. Get the camera in as quick as you can. We flew the camera in, and we just went. And he would go until he was dry. And then we would take a 10-minute break, and we would go again until he was dry. Mm-hmm. And he did, it was a bit abusive, but he loved it. So we enjoyed it. And that was why the cut took so long, the editing took so long, because him and Rachel, both of them, played every scene on every note imaginable. Because usually the actor will give you just one kind of take on it. But then I was like, you know what? Play it as Tomas. Play it as Tom. Play it sad. Play it angry. Play it a little bit more angrier. Okay, play it now really happy. And we just bounced around and tried different things, and it was a joy.
Is your next film going to... Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to ask, so far all three of your films have been interpretive, at least some way open to interpretation. At one point you were attached to do a Batman.
No.
Do you still have...
I wasn't ever attached to do Batman. I was... Batman was a writing gig, and it was about coming off of Requiem for a Dream, dreaming about doing The Fountain, realizing that it was going to cost a decent amount to dime, and seeing how the studio perceived me probably as a guy who just did a $4 million drug movie. When they offered me the chance to do something on Batman, and I realized that I could work with one of my heroes, Frank Miller, I was like, you know what, if I develop this, that might actually open up their perception of me to do The Fountain. But I wasn't really ever... I was really trying to make The Fountain for the last 6 years. That's
so
what
now would you do something again that might be more linear, like a film like that, or will you continue to have this sort of vision for your films?
I'm just going to make them weirder and weirder and weirder.
Is the next one going to be as weird then?
Who knows? I don't know. I think if anything I do gets out there, because that's what, you know, I think we've always been trying to push the envelope of what, you know, you can do in cinema. And, you know, Maddie, my DP, always says we're wild style filmmakers. Wild style was a certain, you know, graffiti writing. It was kind of that crazy writing style. But you could recognize who wrote what all the time by the style of the letters. And I think that's, for us, always been something, is trying to put a visual language into a film that helps tell the story that you're doing, but is incredibly unique and hopefully interesting for people.
At the time you were writing The Fountain, you were saying that at the time that it was put on hold,
yeah,
you said you worked on other things that will probably form the germ of your next movie. Do you
yes.
know that has that germ blossomed
yes.
into a...
Yes.
Can you talk about what...
No.
Okay.
Chud has an exclusive.
We do have that, and I want to actually ask you, because you said it's going to be something biblical. Your first film was about God and math. This film is... spiritual, yeah, in an agnostic way.
Yeah.
What's your take on God? Are you religious? Do you believe in God? I'm curious.
Well, look, I think there's... I think the themes of The Fountain about this endless cycle of energy and matter, you know, tracing back to the Big Bang, you know. Big Bang happens, all this star matter... star matter turns into stars. Stars turn into planets. Planets turn into life. You know, we're all just borrowing this matter and energy for a little bit while we're here until it goes back into everything else. And that connects us all, no matter, you know, the cynics out there laugh at this crap, but it's true. and the messed up thing is how distracted we are and disconnected from that connection, and the result of it is what we're doing to, you know, this planet and to ourselves. We're just completely killing each other and killing the planet, and it's like state of emergency right now, I think. You know, all my charity work has always been about the environment, and it's, 15,000 endangered species on the endangered list, you know, and I like mercury poisoning is my new thing, which is just like, we're doing it to ourselves, you know, the fact that there's mercury poisoning in the North Arctic, you know, breast milk of indigenous people, and it's all coming from us, and we're all, and Alzheimer's is on the rise. It's like, what are we doing to ourselves, you know? So it's like a complete disconnect from that. So to me, that's where the spirituality is, and whatever you want to call it, that connection, you know, some people would use that term God, but that's to me what I think is holy.
Thank you, everybody.
Oh, there we go. Good
PG-13,
yes.
Did you change anything for the PG-13? Or
there was the only change was, we talked about that, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about the change.
No.
Ooh, well, you missed a good part. Oh, wow. Who signed that?
Jared.
Oh, wow. You want it to you?
I'm Fred, if you care.
Yeah, sure.
So, Paulie, can you give us a little
something? I did it. Did you notice a change?
It looked like there was a little bit less violence in one of the conquistador scenes. Am I wrong?
No, there's no change in that. There's change in... there's an added line that was in the trailer but wasn't in the movie, which is the death is a disease, and there's a cure.
Oh.
A cure, I will find it. It's been in the trailer, so you might have gotten confused, but that was a line that Hugh wanted in that I couldn't figure out a place for. And
why do I remember seeing it last night?
I saw it.
Yeah. You saw it. It is last night. Yeah, it's in there. It's in there. You finally... That's the new cut.
But you didn't cut any of the violence.
No. Violence is all the same.
So how did it...
Negotiation.